and welcome back to the Perspectives in History podcast. I'm your host, Willem Kahn. Thank you for listening, as always. This is part 8 of our series on the Korean War, Reversals of Fortune. Well, here we are, about 3 weeks from the last episode. Once again, I offer my sincerest apologies for the delay. The reason that this particular delay was longer than I had intended is because the original draft of the script for this episode would have been about 2 hours long, so I made the decision to split it into two parts for the sake of time management. That said, since the script for the next episode is more or less complete already, I'll try to produce episode 9 as quickly as possible, and I may even release it in less than 2 weeks if I can manage. The script for part 10 is also more or less complete, so I don't anticipate it will be very long before I'm able to release that episode as well. Anyway, we have a lot to go over in this part, so without further ado, let's begin. In the previous episode of this series, we discussed quite a lot of different subject matters, mostly pertaining to the ongoing fallout from China's intervention in the Korean War. In lieu of a more comprehensive recap, I'll try to remind you of the balance of forces on the Korean Peninsula at the beginning of the year 1951. The second phase campaign of the Chinese People's Volunteer Army had resulted in the complete expulsion of United Nations forces from North Korea by late December 1950. A subsequent offensive operation launched on New Year's Day saw the PVA push the enemy further south of the 38th parallel and enabled them to capture the South Korean capital city of Seoul. These significant victories had convinced much of the communist leadership, including Mao Zedong and Kim Il-sung, that total victory was close at hand. Those with a better grasp of the situation, chiefly PVA commander Peng Dehuai, were not as convinced of this. In the roughly 2.5 months since the People's Volunteer Army had first crossed the border into Korea, their strength had been reduced by a significant margin, from 450,000 initially to just 280,000. A great many of these casualties are attributable to the Army's ongoing logistical troubles, as we discussed at length in the previous episode. The incessant bombing campaigns of the U.S. Air Force made it difficult for necessary supplies, such as food, ammunition, and clothing, to reach the front in sufficient quantities. As a result, the Army was losing more and more men to starvation and exposure the further south it marched. What General Peng needed more than anything was time for his army to rest, regroup, and resupply. But to his immense frustration, the pressure on him to press the attack only continued to mount. Meanwhile, on the United Nations side of things, everyone, from soldiers to civilians, from military officers to politicians and diplomats, struggled to adjust to the new reality of the war in Korea. There were vigorous debates among American decision-makers as to how the U.S. should react to this sudden and dramatic reversal of fortune. Some, like UNC Commander Douglas MacArthur, advocated for military retaliation against China itself. Others suggested cutting losses and pulling out of Korea entirely. The course of action that was eventually decided on by President Harry Truman and Secretary of State Dean Acheson lay between these two extremes. The UN would stay in Korea as long as possible and attempt to fight the enemy to a standstill in the hopes of a peace deal that would restore the pre-war status quo. The messaging from the American government made it clear that while China's intervention had forced them to reassess the long-term objectives of the UN mission in Korea, their resolve to turn back the tide of communist aggression remained undiminished. This was perhaps an overly optimistic view of the situation. America's allies within the UN coalition had begun to express their desire to bring hostilities to an end, even if it necessitated some concessions to the enemy. Even public opinion within the United States itself was beginning to turn against the war, with some questioning the strategic significance and even the moral necessity of the United Nations efforts in Korea. This is all to say nothing of the attitudes of the soldiers themselves, which were marked at this time by bitterness, disillusionment, and, above all, by an urgent desire to get out of the country as soon as possible. Morale was near its lowest ebb when, on December 23rd, General Walton Walker, commander of the U.S. 8th Army, which constituted the greater part of UN forces in Korea, was killed in a traffic accident. Ultimately, Walker's death would prove beneficial for the UN's fortunes, as his replacement, Lieutenant General Matthew Ridgway, was a more energetic and proactive leader than his predecessor. Although he was unable to prevent the enemy from capturing Seoul, he was determined to regain the initiative and to launch a counteroffensive as soon as he was able to marshal the forces under his command. The 8th Army's retreat from the north may have been somewhat chaotic, but the important thing was is that it had remained mostly intact, despite the losses inflicted on it in the past weeks. Moreover, the UN retained significant advantages in many respects, including uncontested air superiority and more advanced military equipment. Ridgway's first objective, then, would be to restore the morale of his men. Upon evacuating Seoul, General Ridgway sought to re-establish a new UN defensive line, roughly congruent with the 37th parallel north, and anchored on the town of Pyeongtaek in the west. By January 7th, this had been accomplished, but the enemy had since disengaged and now was nowhere to be found. Ridgway's plan had been to maintain contact with the enemy throughout the withdrawal, and now he was wary of falling into another trap. Throughout the next week, he anticipated an attack by the communist forces, but it never came. Advanced PVA units had pursued the retreating UN forces south of Seoul, but had only made it as far as Incheon when General Peng ordered a halt to the advance on January 8th. The New Year's offensive had been massively successful, more than Peng or even Mao had anticipated. But, of course, this success had come at the cost of thousands of casualties. At the onset of the second phase campaign, the PVA held an imposing numerical advantage over the UN forces, outnumbering them by nearly 2-1. By the end of the third phase offensive, their total strength had been reduced so drastically that they were almost at parity with the UN forces in terms of manpower. Of the troops that did remain, many were so malnourished and exhausted that they could physically not go on even if they had the willpower to do so. A journal entry written by a Chinese officer described the army's ongoing issues in some detail. Quote, difficulties. 1. We have been troubled on the march due to icy roads. 2. We are exhausted from incessant night marching. To make matters worse, when we should be resting during the day, we cannot sleep due to enemy air activity. 3. Due to a shortage of shoes, almost all soldiers are suffering from frostbite. 4. We have had to cross rivers with our uniforms on during combat, which has also resulted in severe frostbite. 5. The fighting is becoming critical due to a lack of food and ammunition. 6. Lack of lubrication causes untimely rifle jams when firing. 7. We have had to carry heavy equipment on our backs, and we are always heavily burdened while marching. 8. The physical condition of our soldiers has been deteriorating, as they have to hide in shelters all day long and fight only at night. 9. When reconnoitering at night, disguised in civilian clothing, it is difficult to carry out this mission because of linguistic difficulties. Morale of the soldiers of our unit, enemy airstrikes frighten the soldiers most of all. The most unbearable labor they have to endure is carrying heavy equipment on their backs while climbing mountain ridges. Their conviction that we will win this war is wavering. End quote. A few days after Peng brought the third phase offensive to a halt, he received a new set of directives from Beijing. The troops of the PVA would finally get the respite that they so desperately needed. They were given 2 to 3 months in which to reorganize, train, and resupply, all the while defending the area around Seoul and Incheon. In his message to Peng, Mao offered his assessment of the strategic situation overall. Quote, the enemy command probably has two options for future military action. 1. After light resistance to pressure from Chinese and North Korean troops, the enemy will withdraw from Korea. In this case, it would be due to our own thorough preparations. Having obtained intelligence about our preparatory measures, the enemy will be convinced that our forces are even stronger and, fearing difficulty, will withdraw. 2. The enemy will continue stiff resistance in the Busan-Daegu area until they are convinced that resistance is useless, after which point they will withdraw from Korea. In this case, we must be fully prepared so that we can continue the fight. End quote. Continuing on, Mao acknowledged the possibility that a new offensive operation may have to be carried out in February to stave off potential enemy advances, but in any case, he anticipated that the final, decisive battle would take place that spring. Now, before I go much further, there is a fairly important development that I have to cover now that I had neglected to in previous episodes. In early December 1950, in advance of the recapture of Pyongyang, Chairman Kim paid a visit to Beijing to meet with Chairman Mao, Zhou Enlai, and Liu Shaoqi to personally express his gratitude for their decision to intervene. While he was there, the Chinese proposed creating a unified military command. Although they couched it in terms of facilitating effective cooperation and whatnot, Kim realized that he would effectively be handing over control of the Korean People's Army to the Chinese. Given the current balance of forces, however, Kim also realized that he was in no real position to refuse. In the final draft of the agreement, the PVA-KPA Joint Headquarters was granted a large degree of authority on nearly all matters pertaining to the war effort, including not only the ability to issue orders to troops in the field, but to control transportation and communication infrastructure, to requisition supplies and mobilize personnel, and the right to arbitrate all media reporting on combat operations. Although Peng Dehuai was designated as the commander and political commissar of the Joint Headquarters, Two Koreans, Kim Ung and Park Il-yu, were made vice commander and vice commissar, respectively. As for Chairman Kim, although he remained the nominal supreme commander of the KPA, he now no longer played any meaningful role in the army's day-to-day operations. On January 11th, Kim Il-sung and DPRK Vice Chairman Park Han-young paid a visit to General Peng's field headquarters at Kumhwa, 50 or so miles northeast of Seoul, to discuss strategy. Both Kim and Park were in the highest of spirits, absolutely confident that they were on the verge of complete victory. In fact, the DPRK's state radio had already declared, perhaps somewhat prematurely, that 1951 was the year of victory. Peng, on the other hand, was not as optimistic. He had been hesitant to launch the New Year's offensive in the first place, and now he was determined to stay in place throughout the rest of the winter. Nonetheless, the North Koreans were anxious to follow up on their recent successes. They proposed having the KPA continue the advance southward by themselves, to be joined by their Chinese comrades when they were ready to do so. Peng urged patience, arguing that they would only be playing into the enemy's hands with such a move. While China's entry into the conflict had relieved the pressure on the KPA and bought it some time to rebuild, Peng did not think that the army had recovered sufficiently enough to undertake such a dangerous mission on its own. He understood that the UN forces had only evacuated Seoul in order to take up better defensive positions further south. There was no chance that the KPA in its current state would be able to destroy the enemy by themselves, and that by attempting to expand their territory without destroying the enemy would only make them more vulnerable. Park countered that it was not necessary to completely destroy the UN forces, but just to pursue them. He claimed that according to the most recent intelligence reports from Moscow, they were already preparing to withdraw from the peninsula, and that all they needed was a little encouragement. Peng was not convinced, but Kim and Park persisted, at which point Peng lost his temper. Raising his voice, he rebuked his Korean comrade severely, quote, "You're dreaming. In the past, you said that the US would never send troops. You never thought about what would happen if they did. Now you say that the American army will definitely withdraw from Korea, but you are not considering what to do if they do not. You are gambling with the fate of your people, and that will only lead to disaster." End quote. He restated his conviction that the army needed at least 2 more months to recover. He told Kim that if he wanted to, he could go ahead and take the KPA and move forward with or without Chinese support, but he made it clear that, quote, "Without considerable preparation, not one division can advance south. I resolutely oppose this mistake that you are making in underestimating the enemy. If you think that I am not doing my job well, you can fire me, court-martial me, or even kill me." End quote. Sufficiently chastised, the Koreans backed down. Thanks in part to Peng's forceful words, Chairman Kim would temper his emotions and adopt a more measured, cautious outlook on the situation overall. Joseph Stalin also, upon hearing of the heated exchange between Kim and Peng, weighed in, quote, "The leadership of the Chinese Volunteer Army is correct. Undoubtedly, the truth lies with Commander Peng Dehuai." End quote. Thus, of the three principal leaders of the Communist faction, only one maintained the blind optimism born out of the victory in the first three offensives, Mao. A bit ago, I summarized the dispatch he'd sent to Peng on January 14th, in which he outlined the two possible courses of action he believed the UN forces would take, with both scenarios ending in their complete withdrawal from Korea. From his perspective in faraway Beijing, it's easy to see why the chairman thought this way. In just 3 months, the Chinese had met with remarkable success, kicking the enemy out of the north entirely, retaking the North Korean capital, and even capturing the South Korean one. An editorial in the Communist Party's official newspaper, People's Daily, reporting on the fall of Seoul reflected the triumphalist attitude of Mao and his associates at this time. Quote, "March on, Korean People's Army and Chinese People's Volunteers. March on for the independence and freedom of Korea, for the security of China and the entire East. March on to Daejeon, Daegu, and Busan. And if the Americans refuse to leave, push them into the ocean." End quote. But, much like MacArthur in September 1950, Mao's overconfidence had led him to make a grave miscalculation. The prospect of a complete victory was so tantalizing that he had become deaf to the warnings of his field commanders. It was for these reasons that Mao rejected a ceasefire proposed by the United Nations in early January. The five-part proposal would have involved an immediate ceasefire, pending a more permanent armistice agreement, and the complete withdrawal of all foreign troops from the peninsula. Subsequently, a new international organization would be established, consisting of the US, Britain, the USSR, and China, for the purposes of settling East Asian affairs, which included, among other things, arranging a provisional government for a united Korean state and arbitrating the ongoing disputes over Taiwan. Although the Truman administration publicly announced its support for the Armistice Initiative, it had not reached that decision easily. In fact, by doing so, Truman and his Secretary of State Dean Acheson had made quite the gamble. The points of this proposal, which had been drawn up by Indian diplomats, were not designed to be the most favorable to American interests. For one, the proposal recommended that the ceasefire be put into effect along the current front line, the 37th parallel rather than the 38th. Agreeing to this would have, in effect, ceded a considerable amount of South Korea's pre-war territory to the communists, including Seoul. Moreover, there were concerns that the composition of the proposed new international body for East Asian affairs was such that the U.S. was likely to be outvoted if it came to any decision regarding Taiwan, given Britain's open support for the PRC's bid to take Taiwan's seat at the UN. In short, accepting these terms would have been tantamount to conceding defeat. Not only did the armistice arrangement have the potential to strike a severe blow to America's geostrategic interests in Asia, to say nothing of the potential damage to its international prestige, but there would have been also grave ramifications domestically. The Truman administration's handling of the war effort was already facing mounting criticism from people with a wide range of political beliefs. As we touched on in the previous episode, many on the more liberal end of the spectrum had begun to question America's role in the Korean conflict, especially in light of reports regarding the South Korean government's violent crackdown on suspected political dissidents. On the other hand, the administration's more conservative critics accused it of mismanaging the war effort. The more moderate among them attributed this mismanagement to either incompetence or indecisiveness, but more extreme ones took things further. The Truman administration's most intractable opponents, a group of Republican Party politicians centered around Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, alleged that the American government had been infiltrated by numerous communist sympathizers. McCarthy had been building a national following for about a year already, having first made headlines in February 1950 for a speech in which he claimed, quote, "While I cannot take the time to name all of the men in the State Department who have been named as members of the Communist Party and members of a spy ring, I have in my hand a list of 205, a list of names that were known to the Secretary of State and who nevertheless are still working and shaping the policy of the State Department," end quote. The immediate catalyst for these claims had actually been the victory of the communists in the Chinese Civil War, which was characterized by McCarthy and others as the loss of China. The primary target of their vitriol, at least at first, was Acheson, who McCarthy called, quote, "this pompous diplomat in striped pants," end quote, and, quote, "a dilettante diplomat who cringes before the Soviet colossus," end quote. After China's intervention in Korea, the McCarthyites stepped up their rhetoric, with McCarthy asserting that blame for the, quote, "Korean death trap can be laid squarely at the doors of the Kremlin and everyone who sabotaged the rearming, including Acheson and the president," end quote. Secretary of Defense George Marshall, and of course President Truman, also caught an increasing amount of flack at this time. The accusation most commonly leveled against these two and the Secretary of State was not necessarily that they themselves were closeted communists, as this would have made the accusers liable to legal action. Rather, they were alleged to have appeased, protected, or otherwise tolerated the presence of communist sympathizers within the American government. Today, the name Joseph McCarthy has become synonymous with demagoguery and character assassination, and although it's obvious to us now that his accusations were unsubstantiated, at the time, such facts were not so self-evident. Distasteful as their anti-communist scare tactics may have been to some people, McCarthy and his allies proved themselves to be shrewd manipulators of public opinion, simultaneously exploiting the public's growing dissatisfaction with the government's handling of the situation in Korea and stoking fears about communist subversion for their political gain. To his credit, Acheson maintained his composure in the face of these increasingly vitriolic attacks against him, humorously dismissing McCarthyite criticism as, quote, "a revolt of the primitives against intelligence," end quote. Nonetheless, this revolt of the primitives was not something that the Truman administration could afford to just ignore. It was a manifestation of a broader loss of confidence in their ability to handle the war. And it was not just the president's re-election campaign or the Democratic Party's control of Congress that was at stake here. If the so-called primitives got their way, an escalation of the war would be inevitable, perhaps the outbreak of a Third World War. So, with all that being said, now you should better understand why backing the armistice proposal at the UN was seen as such a risk. If China agreed to stop the hostilities on these terms, the American public would view it as a concession of defeat, thereby lending credence to the accusations of their opponents. With President Truman's approval rating at its lowest to date, 33% as of December 1950, and dropping lower by the month, Acheson was well aware of the potential for such a turn of events to, quote, bring the administration to the verge of destruction domestically, end quote. This has all been to say nothing of how the South Koreans were liable to react to losing a third of their country, including their capital, to the communists. In short, the risks were considerable, but Acheson was confident that, based on his assessment, the Chinese would reject the proposal. Truman, who always maintained complete confidence in his Secretary of State, was persuaded to take the chance. Just as Acheson had anticipated, the Chinese unequivocally rejected the ceasefire terms on January 17th. This decision played to the United States' advantage on the diplomatic front. By refusing the olive branch and electing to continue the war, the U.S. would be able to brand China as the aggressor in this conflict and restore some of the United Nations' moral credibility. The American ambassador to the UN, Warren Austin, wasted little time in proposing a resolution to the General Assembly to condemn China as an aggressor. After some minor quibbling regarding the specific language that was to be used, the resolution was approved by the UN General Assembly on February 1st. Of the UN's 60 member states, 44 voted in favor of the resolution, 7 voted against, and 9 abstained, with most of the negative votes and abstentions coming from other communist countries. It was mainly with the aim of stabilizing the domestic political situation that Acheson and other State Department officials had pushed for the resolution to formally condemn China, and in this regard, it can be considered a success. The day after the resolution passed, an American journalist gave his analysis of the situation. Quote, "This past November, when the Chinese suddenly invaded Korea and put the great UN army to flight, there was a terrible feeling, as though the whole structure of the free world was about to collapse. We started descending down a psychological spiral. Stalin must have rubbed his hands with incredulous joy. Yet now, nearly all the talk here in the capital, both public and private, is confident on Korea, on Europe, on the United Nations and the Western Alliance, and on domestic military production. Nowhere except in Korea has the physical situation changed very much, but the psychological situation has changed tremendously." End quote. The extent to which the aggressor resolution affected the broader diplomatic situation is less clear. The text of the resolution called on all member states of the United Nations to redouble their efforts to repulse communist aggression in Korea, but although all countries who had contributed forces to the coalition already had voted in favor, there was a noticeable lack of enthusiasm for the initiative among them, especially from the UK, whose diplomats expressed concerns that the resolution may be unnecessarily provocative. Publicly, China reacted to the resolution as one might expect. On February 2nd, Foreign Minister Zhou Enlai issued a statement condemning the resolution as, quote, "illegal, slanderous, null, and void," end quote. Some historians have speculated that the resolution did induce a shift in the strategic thinking of the Chinese leadership away from the idea of total victory and towards a more realistic outcome. As we'll see soon enough, though, it appears far more likely that developments on the battlefield were more responsible for this change rather than developments at the UN. Speaking of which, it's time we got back to the military side of things. When we diverted last from the military narrative, we had just finished covering the Chinese third phase offensive from January 1st to the 7th. Having only just assumed command over the 8th Army, Lieutenant General Matthew Ridgway did not have sufficient time to make preparations to defend Seoul against a large-scale assault. Unwilling to waste the lives of his men by attempting to hold the capital, Ridgway ordered the evacuation of the city on January 3rd, just 3 days into the offensive. This was not a decision he had made lightly, but he was confident that it would be only a matter of time before the UN forces would get back on their feet and retake Seoul. As the 8th Army established new defensive positions along the 37th parallel, about 60 kilometers south of Seoul, in the second and third weeks of January 1951, Ridgway remained vigilant, anticipating that the enemy would attack at any moment. The attack never came. Still, the general was no less committed to launching a counteroffensive as soon as it was possible, but he remained wary of falling into another trap. The UN forces had lost contact with the enemy shortly after the fall of Seoul. They were simply nowhere to be found. Because reconnaissance aircraft were unable to provide any useful intel regarding enemy troop movements, Ridgway ordered a reconnaissance in force operation by the ground forces beginning in mid-January. Essentially, this would involve larger formations of troops, whose objective was not to capture and hold territory, but to provoke the enemy into attacking and thereby revealing their location. The initial probes only resulted in sporadic contact with the enemy, and uncovered no evidence of a significant enemy force between the UN lines and Suwon, a city about halfway down the road to Seoul. Feeling emboldened by this result, Ridgway ordered a general advance to begin on January 25th. To cover the ground forces, Ridgway ordered the Air Force to, quote, methodically destroy dwellings and all other buildings north of the front without delay, end quote. This was intended to deprive the enemy of any places to hide, but once again, the main thing it accomplished was killing or wounding more civilians and displacing even more refugees. On January 19th, U.S. aircraft attacked the village of Sanseong-dong in east-central South Korea, killing 50 of its inhabitants and destroying most of its buildings. Those who survived the ordeal tried to flee southward, but they encountered U.S. Army soldiers blocking the road, who threatened to shoot them if they tried to pass. These refugees, along with those from other nearby villages also subjected to airstrikes, sought shelter in a cave that the locals referred to as Gokgyeul, or the Cave of the Crying Stream. Further tragedy unfolded the next day when American planes proceeded to bomb the cave as well. At least 200 civilians were killed in this attack, either being burned to death by napalm munitions, suffocating to death from smoke inhalation, or being shot by strafing fighters as they tried to escape. A survivor of the attack named Cho Byung-woo, who was 9 years old at the time, later recalled his experience, quote, "People screamed out in the darkness. It was hell. How could they not tell civilians from North Korean troops? They wouldn't have died like that if they had allowed refugees to pass through their lines," end quote. A patrol of U.S. infantrymen passed the cave later that month and confirmed that there were no enemy combatants among the dead. In another indiscriminate airstrike on the village of Anyang, just south of Seoul, over 200 people were killed, including about 100 orphaned children, in what he called, quote, "a macabre tribute to the totality of modern war," end quote. New York Times correspondent George Barrett reported on the aftermath, quote, "A napalm raid hit the village 3 or 4 days ago, when the Chinese were holding up the advance, and nowhere in the village have they buried the dead because there is no one left to do so. This correspondent came across one old woman, the only one who seemed to be left alive, dazedly hanging up some clothes in a blackened courtyard filled with the bodies of 4 members of her family. The inhabitants throughout the village and in the fields were caught and kept in the exact postures they held when the napalm struck. A man about to get on his bicycle, 50 boys and girls playing in an orphanage, a housewife holding in her hand a page torn from a Sears Roebuck catalog, crayoned at mail order number 3811 for a $2.98 bewitching bed jacket in coral. There must be almost 200 dead in this tiny hamlet," end quote. Both of the attacks I just described, the one at Gokgyeul Cave and the one at Anyang, were quickly covered up. If you'll recall from the previous episode, I mentioned how General MacArthur had imposed blanket censorship on all reporting coming out of Korea in response to the fallout from the December massacres. General Ridgway was every bit as keen to suppress any news stories that painted the UN or the ROK in a negative light, and so he ensured that information regarding these two attacks was buried immediately, even going so far as to shut down an investigation into the cave attack that had been opened by the Air Force Inspector General at the behest of South Korean authorities. Knowledge of these incidents was only uncovered as recently as the early 2000s, thanks to the work of the South Korean Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Part of the reason why Ridgway had been so quick to act in preventing these stories from breaking was because of the attention that he was paying to his army's morale. He'd learned from his tours of the front that many of the soldiers were beginning to question why they were in this country to begin with. Widespread knowledge of the attacks at Anyang and Gokgyeul Cave had the potential to deal a fatal blow to the men's spirits. Aware that news of these civilian deaths may spread through the ranks by word of mouth anyway, Ridgway did preemptive damage control by issuing a memorandum addressed to the men of the 8th Army on January 24th. In this letter, he sought to address 2 rhetorical questions, those being, why are we here and what are we fighting for? His response to these queries was as follows, quote, "To me, the issues are clear. It is not a question of this or that Korean town or village. Real estate is here incidental. It is not restricted to the issue of freedom for our South Korean allies, whose fidelity and valor under the severe stresses of battle we recognize, though that freedom is a symbol of the wider issues, and included among them. The real issues are whether the power of Western civilization, as God has permitted it to flower in our own beloved lands, shall defy and defeat communism, whether the rule of men who shoot their prisoners, enslave their citizens, and deride the dignity of man shall displace the rule of those to whom the individual and his rights are sacred, whether we are to survive with God's hand to guide and lead us, or to perish in the dead existence of a godless world. If these be true, and to us they are, beyond any possibility of challenge, then this has long ceased to be a fight for freedom for our Korean allies alone, and for their national survival. It has become, and continues to be, a fight for our own freedom, for our own survival, in an honorable, independent, national existence. The sacrifices we have made, and those we shall yet support, are not offered vicariously for others, but in our own direct defense. In the final analysis, the issue now joined right here in Korea is whether communism or individual freedom shall prevail. And, make no mistake, wherever the next flight of fear-driven people we have just witnessed across the Han River, and continue to witness in other areas, shall be checked and defeated overseas or permitted, step by step, to close in on our own homeland, and at some future time, however distant, to engulf our own loved ones in all its misery and despair. These are the things for which we fight. Never have members of any military command had a greater challenge than we, or a finer opportunity to show ourselves and our people at their best, and thus to be an honor to the profession of arms and a credit to those who raised us." End quote. The reconnaissance and force operations and the bombing campaign that accompanied them were only precursors to the larger general offensive that Ridgway had been preparing since he first took command. The next phase of Operation Thunderbolt began on January 30th, with the objective being to advance to the Han River, which bisects this capital city of Seoul. For Peng Dehuai, this was not an ideal turn of events. While a UN counteroffensive had not come as a total surprise, it had come much earlier than he had anticipated. On February 4th, the general wrote a dispatch to Beijing, quote, "We are obliged to begin the fourth phase of operations. The battle begins now under unfavorable conditions. Our period of rest is interrupted, and we are not yet ready to fight." End quote. By the 5th, the 8th Army had re-established contact with communist forces to the west and south of the Han River, but it was not certain whether their next move would be to fall back and to re-establish a defensive line or to counterattack immediately. Ridgway thought that the latter was more plausible, and based on the limited intelligence he had, he thought the counterattack would take place further to the east. Their objective would likely be to capture the city of Wonju, given that last month they had captured the city but lost it to UN forces again after just 2 weeks. Holding Wonju was deemed to be highly significant, given its strategic location, as losing it would put the enemy within striking distance of Daegu and by extension Busan. The task of defending it fell to the 10th Corps. On February 5th, the 10th Corps launched Operation Roundup, intending to put pressure on the PVA and KPA by first taking the town of Hongseong, about 12 miles to the northwest, then pushing on to Hongcheon, about 18 more miles in the same direction. The 10th Corps had only just managed to accomplish this first objective when the communists launched their own counterattack on the night of February 11th. The commander of the 10th Corps, General Edward Almond, had placed the ROK Army divisions under his command at the vanguard of his force, and one of these divisions, the 8th, bore the brunt of the initial attack. Hit by three PVA divisions simultaneously, they suffered heavy casualties and were forced to retreat in a matter of hours. The near-complete destruction of this division put the rest of 10th Corps, two American divisions and a Dutch regiment, in grave danger. While they managed to retreat back to Hongseong mostly intact, their losses were still heavy, about 1,900 casualties total, not to mention the over 9,000 suffered by the South Koreans. In fact, the losses of both men and equipment were so severe that Ridgway had an investigation opened to determine who was at fault for these losses. Emboldened by the victory at Hongseong, the Chinese and North Korean forces pressed on to Wonju, where they attacked a somewhat diminished 10th Corps on February 13th. There, however, they ran up against overwhelming enemy artillery and were forced to pull back after the failure of an initial attack. The KPA tried to break through UN lines at Wonju a couple more times in the days that followed, but to no avail. Concurrently, a more consequential battle was taking place some 20 miles to the northwest at the village of Chipyongni, where the U.S. Army 23rd Infantry Regiment, along with elements of the French Battalion, held out for 2 days against the Chinese force twice their size. The UN victories at Wonju and Chipyongni brought the Chinese fourth phase offensive to an abrupt halt, repulsing the communist advance and forcing them to withdraw further north to reinforce Seoul in the anticipation of further UN offensive operations. Many historians credit these two battles as being critical turning points in the war, marking the moment at which the UN was finally able to get back on its feet after the disastrous final months of 1950. Hoping to maintain this momentum and to keep up pressure on the enemy, on February 20th, Ridgway had the 8th Army commence a new offensive operation dubbed Operation Killer, so-called because one of its stated objectives was to entrap and kill as many enemy soldiers as possible while pushing further to the north. In the wake of the abortive fourth phase campaign, Peng Dehuai traveled to Beijing to meet with Mao at the end of February. This meeting was significant as it was the first time that Peng had met with the chairman in person since he'd first led the People's Volunteer Army into Korea in October of the previous year. It was also their first meeting since the untimely death of the chairman's eldest son, An Ying. Now, this is something that I really should have discussed in a past episode, seeing as how it took place in November 1950, but couldn't find the time to make such a digression. Anyway, Mao Anying was born in 1922 to Mao Zedong's second wife, Yang Kaihui. Being the son of a communist revolutionary at a time when China was engulfed by civil war, his life had not been an easy one. In 1930, while her husband was leading a communist uprising in neighboring Jiangxi province, Yang Kaihui was captured by a nationalist warlord and executed. Unable to join their father, Anying and his younger brothers were effectively orphaned and resorted to begging on the streets of Shanghai to survive. After living like this for 6 years, one of Mao's agents managed to track the children down. Anying and one of his brothers were sent to study in the Soviet Union for their own safety. Graduating from the Frunze Military Academy in 1943, Anying served as a political commissar in the Red Army and participated in actions against the German Reich in Eastern Europe until the end of the war, after which point he returned to China to assist with the struggle against the nationalists. When the People's Volunteer Army was being formed, Anying joined, serving directly under General Peng as his personal secretary. Peng was quite hesitant to have Anying on his staff. He knew that it would be very dangerous, and that if anything bad happened to the chairman's son, there might be severe repercussions for him. But Mao insisted. On November 25th, Peng and his staff were in a makeshift command headquarters, little more than a requisition cabin, in Tungcheong County in northwestern Korea. Late in the afternoon, American planes were heard flying overhead, prompting Peng and his staff to flee the cabin for a nearby cave, which offered them better protection against aerial attack. From the relative safety of the cave, they could hear the planes circling overhead, followed by explosions. Once the planes flew off, Peng and the others exited the cave to survey the damage. The cabin was now a flaming wreckage, the result of napalm munitions. Two officers had still been inside at the time, and although both of their bodies had been burned beyond recognition, a quick headcount revealed that one of them was Mao Anying. Why exactly he had failed to make it out of the building in time is uncertain, the subject of much speculation by historians. Whatever the case, Peng now had to face his superior in person after the death of his eldest son. The stated purpose of their meeting was to discuss strategy, but it was not long before the subject of Anying's death arose. Peng offered his condolences and expressed his shame at having failed to protect Mao's son. Mao, on the other hand, visibly stricken with grief, felt he shared in the general's culpability. After all, it was at his insistence that Anying had been assigned to Peng's staff in the first place. Mao tried to reassure Peng that it was not all his fault. Quote, "He's just one of thousands who are dying in Korea. You shouldn't take it as something significant just because he was my son." End quote. Following a prolonged moment of silence, the discussion shifted to more immediate concerns. Peng filled in his superior on the situation. He told Mao nothing that he hadn't already tried to communicate in his dispatches. The army's logistics were still in disarray, there was still a critical shortage of supplies, they were still losing large numbers of men as battlefield casualties, and even more from starvation, illness, exposure, and so on. The enemy's air superiority continued to wreak havoc both physically and mentally, and in the end, Peng concluded that the war in Korea was not one that could be won quickly. To this, Mao responded laconically, quote, "Win a quick victory if you can. If you can't, win a slow one." End quote. In a letter written to Stalin dated March 2nd, a somewhat sobered Mao elaborated on what he meant by a slow victory. Quote, "The most recent offensive on the Korean battlefield shows us that unless the bulk of the enemy forces is destroyed, the enemy will not withdraw from Korea. A certain amount of time is needed to accomplish this. Thus, it is possible that military operations in Korea may be of a prolonged character. We should assume that this will take at least 2 years." End quote. For the time being, it seems that the failure of the PVA's offensive in February had finally forced Mao to recognize that total victory in Korea was not possible given the current balance of power on the peninsula. The communists would have to significantly build up their forces before undertaking the decisive offensive that would finally push the Americans into the sea, but in order to do this, the army needed a respite. They'd have to give up significant ground to the enemy in the short term, perhaps even Seoul, but Mao was confident that they would be back. Meanwhile, in Korea, the UN was launching the next phase of its counteroffensive, Operation Killer. As I mentioned, one of General Ridgway's objectives in this operation was to completely destroy the communist forces that stood between the UN lines in Seoul. In this, they proved unsuccessful. The PVA and KPA were already undertaking a full-scale retreat, and while the UN managed to inflict some casualties, they were denied the chance for a single decisive battle that Ridgway had hoped for. By March 6th, the communist forces withdrew back across the Imjin River, which ran alongside the 38th parallel in the western half of the country. With UN forces closing in on Seoul from the south and east, the next phase of the UN counteroffensive, Operation Ripper, commenced on March 7th. Threatened with encirclement, communist forces abandoned Seoul without putting up a fight. A week later, the 1st Coalition troops, elements of the ROK Army 1st Division and U.S. Army 3rd Infantry Division, entered the city. This was the fourth time the South Korean capital had changed hands in the course of the conflict, and this fact was reflected by the state that the American and South Korean troops found it in. Over the past week, relentless bombardment by American artillery had inflicted even further damage on a city that had already been devastated by war. The city's population, which stood at 1.5 million prior to the war, had been reduced to just 200,000. Those who remained in the city, those who either could not make it out on time or refused to, were freezing and starving. United Nations officials tasked with post-war reconstruction estimated that between 50 and 60% of Seoul's housing had been destroyed, along with 85% of its industrial capacity. An American journalist reporting on the recapture of Seoul remarked that it was like, quote, capturing a tomb, end quote. Unlike when the city was initially recaptured by UN forces after the Battle of Incheon 6 months ago, the recapture of Seoul in March 1951 was a far more somber and subdued occasion. There were no grand ceremonies, no triumphant speeches, and no parades through the streets. The South Korean soldiers who entered the city first merely removed the DPRK flag that flew from the ruins of the Capitol building and replaced it with their own. The war-weary denizens of Seoul were likely too preoccupied with scavenging for food and firewood to even take notice. As the UN forces continued to regain ground, the question of the 38th parallel was raised once again. On March 7th, General MacArthur flew to Korea to tour the front lines, visit soldiers, and so on. Then, he read a statement to the press in which he lambasted the Truman administration for imposing what he called, quote, abnormal military inhibitions, end quote, and predicting that the war could only end in an indecisive stalemate in which thousands more would die for practically nothing unless these aforementioned military inhibitions were lifted. Here, MacArthur was not only challenging the President and the Joint Chiefs of Staff more or less openly, but he was also in blatant violation of the gag rule that was in place on all public discussion of military and foreign policy matters pertaining to Korea. 5 days later, General Ridgway held a press conference of his own, where he stated that he regarded the goal of the UN in Korea as restoring the Republic of Korea to its pre-war borders. He also went on to state that, quote, "We didn't set out to conquer China," end quote, a comment almost certainly directed towards MacArthur. In the last episode, we briefly discussed how a new consensus formed in Washington, D.C. in the wake of China's intervention. Nearly everyone in a position of power now agreed that Korean reunification was no longer plausible, and that the best outcome that could be reasonably hoped for was a return to the pre-war status quo. Even if no one stated it outright, this is what the UN's objective in Korea had changed to. Still, MacArthur would not reassess his goals, even if the strategic situation warranted it. He firmly maintained that every effort should be made to reunify the Korean Peninsula, and that UN forces should push all the way to the Yalu River once again, perhaps even beyond it. Throughout February and March, MacArthur sent numerous requests to the Joint Chiefs of Staff to authorize the bombing of targets along the Sino-Korean border, requests that were all denied. It was starting to become clear to MacArthur that he was in the minority. Nearly everyone else had recognized the fact that China's intervention had made a sustained offensive north of the 38th parallel, like the one that they had undertaken last year, far more difficult, if not impossible. After the recapture of Seoul, many among the UN coalition leadership favored opening armistice negotiations with China now that they could negotiate from a position of more or less equal strength. On March 20th, the Joint Chiefs of Staff wrote to MacArthur informing him of President Truman's intention to, quote, engage in further diplomatic efforts toward settlement before any major advance with forces north of the 38th parallel, end quote. The general would hear none of it. His reply read in part, quote, "I recommend that no further military restrictions be imposed on the United Nations command in Korea. The military disadvantages arising from these restrictions, coupled with the disparity between the size of our command and the enemy's ground potential, render it completely impractical to attempt to clear North Korea or to even make any appreciable effort towards that end." End quote. 4 days later, MacArthur issued his most provocative public statement to date. Indirectly addressing the Chinese political and military leadership, MacArthur's communique began with an extended analysis of China's military shortcomings, followed immediately by an implicit threat to expand the war to the Chinese mainland. Quote, "These military weaknesses have been clearly and definitely revealed since Red China entered upon its undeclared war in Korea. Even under the inhibitions which now restrict the activity of the United Nations forces and the corresponding military advantages which accrue to Red China, it has been shown its complete inability to accomplish by force of arms the conquest of Korea. The enemy, therefore, must by now be painfully aware that a decision of the United Nations to depart from its tolerant effort to contain the war to the area of Korea through an expansion of our military operations to its coastal areas and interior bases would doom Red China to the risk of imminent military collapse. End quote. He concluded his statement by informing the Chinese that he was willing to enter into negotiations with them directly. Quote, apart from the military area of the problem, where issues are of course result in combat, the fundamental questions are political in nature, and therefore must find answer in the diplomatic sphere. Within the area of my authority as the military commander, however, it would be needless to say that I stand ready at any time to confer with the commander-in-chief of the enemy forces in the earnest effort to find any means by which the realization of the political objectives of the United Nations in Korea, to which no nation may justly take exception, might be accomplished without the need for further bloodshed. End quote. There was no positive reaction forthcoming from the communist camp, only a flurry of angry denunciations. Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Vyshinsky called MacArthur, quote, a maniac, the principal culprit, the evil genius behind this war, end quote. But it was obvious that MacArthur's communique was not genuinely directed at the enemy. Rather, his intended audience had been his own superiors. Not only had MacArthur once again violated the standing gag order, but by going over the heads of the White House and State Department by appealing to the Chinese leadership directly, he'd blatantly usurped the president's authority and potentially sabotaged his peace initiative. As one could assume, the reaction in Washington, D.C. was apoplectic. Secretary of State Dean Acheson described MacArthur's statement as, quote, defiance of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sabotage of an operation of which he had been informed, and insubordination of the grossest sort to his commander-in-chief, end quote. When he met with said commander-in-chief the following day, Acheson described Truman in the following terms, quote, although perfectly calm, he appeared to be in a state of mind that combined disbelief with controlled fury, end quote. In his memoirs, Truman later wrote the following, quote, this was a most extraordinary statement for a military commander of the United Nations to issue on his own responsibility. It was an act totally disregarding all the directives to abstain from any declarations on foreign policy. It was in open defiance of my orders as president and as commander-in-chief. This was a challenge to the authority of the president under the Constitution. It also flouted the policy of the United Nations. By this act, MacArthur left me no choice. I could no longer tolerate his insubordination, end quote. But while the president had finally resolved to relieve MacArthur of his position, he was hesitant to take action immediately, wary as he was of the political ramifications that such an act would have. Earlier in this episode, I spoke at length about how the course of the war in Korea had impacted American domestic politics, and how the American public was highly dissatisfied with the president's management of the war effort. Truman's approval rating had reached an all-time low in December of the previous year, and though the tides were shifting in the UN's favor, the steadily rising casualty figures being reported from Korea had not done him any favors. The fact of the matter was that the people were tired of the war, and General MacArthur remained popular because he seemed to be the only public figure who still spoke openly of bringing the conflict to a victorious conclusion. Given the current political climate, Truman reasoned that if he were to take immediate disciplinary action against MacArthur, the public would see it as being rash and unjustified, and side with the general. Truman needed a more solid pretext by which to dismiss MacArthur, and considering the general's temperament, it would be only a matter of time before he provided one. On April 5th, Joe Martin, U.S. Representative from Massachusetts, read aloud a letter he'd received from General MacArthur. Earlier that year, Martin gave a speech calling for the use of Chinese nationalist troops to open a second front in the war, and accused the Truman administration of having a defeatist policy. A longtime admirer of MacArthur, the congressman wrote to the general asking for his own thoughts on the matter. Unsurprisingly, Martin and MacArthur were of the same mind. In his response, the general made no effort to conceal his disagreements with the president and his administration. Quote, it seems strangely difficult for some to realize that here in Asia is where the communist conspirators have elected to make their play for global conquest, and that we have joined the issue thus raised on the battlefield. If we lose the war to communism in Asia, the fall of Europe is inevitable. Win it, and Europe most probably would avoid war and yet preserve freedom. As you pointed out, we must win. There is no substitute for victory. End quote. At about the same time, intelligence reports reached Washington, D.C. concerning the mobilization of the Soviet military, leading some to conclude that they too were preparing to enter the conflict in Korea. As a precaution, Truman, at the recommendation of the Joint Chiefs, ordered 9 atomic bombs to be transferred to U.S. air bases in Guam, within striking distance of China. The president had already signed an order authorizing the military to launch retaliatory strikes on Chinese airbases in Manchuria in the event of air attacks against UN forces originating from outside Korea. This order also accounted for the use of atomic weapons, albeit conditional on the president's explicit authorization. Still, the Joint Chiefs were concerned that, given MacArthur's propensity for insubordination, he may have an order like this carried out without waiting for a response from the president. Anyone with the responsibility of making such a heavy decision must be level-headed and responsible, and as of late, MacArthur had proven that he was neither. It was of paramount importance that he be removed from his command immediately before he plunged the world into a new global conflict. In short, it was this exact confluence of events in early April 1951, Representative Martin's presentation of MacArthur's letter before Congress, and the U.S. response to the potential threat posed by the Soviets that sealed MacArthur's fate. On April 6th, an emergency meeting of the cabinet was held in the White House to discuss how the MacArthur situation should be handled. All present agreed that MacArthur had to go, but there remained a degree of uncertainty regarding how to go about it. 2 days later, the Joint Chiefs of Staff presented to the Secretary of Defense their unanimous recommendation that MacArthur be relieved of duty immediately. With the approval of the JCS secured, Truman had the chairman, Omar Bradley, draft the order officially removing MacArthur from his positions as the Supreme Commander of the Allied Powers, the Commander-in-Chief of the United Nations Command, and Commander-in-Chief of the Far East Command, with orders to turn over all of these commands to General Matthew Ridgway. The order was signed on April 10th. Truman intended to have the Secretary of the Army, Frank Pace, deliver the message to MacArthur in person, but for some reason it did not reach the Secretary in time. Rather than risking the story leaking to the press, Truman opted to give the announcement at a press conference in the early morning hours of April 11th. The President's statement was as follows, quote, "With deep regret, I have concluded that General of the Army Douglas MacArthur is unable to give his wholehearted support to the policies of the United States government and of the United Nations in matters pertaining to his official duties. In view of the specific responsibilities imposed on me by the Constitution of the United States and the added responsibility which has been entrusted to me by the United Nations, I have decided that I must make a change of command in the Far East. I, therefore, have relieved General MacArthur of his commands and have designated Lieutenant General Matthew B. Ridgway as his successor. Full and vigorous debate on matters of national policy is a vital element in the constitutional system of our free democracy. It is fundamental, however, that military commanders must be governed by the policies and directives issued to them in the manner provided by our laws and constitution. In a time of crisis, this consideration is particularly compelling. General MacArthur's place in history as one of our greatest commanders is fully established. The nation owes him a debt of gratitude for the distinguished and exceptional service which he has rendered his country in posts of great responsibility. For that reason, I repeat my regret at the necessity of the action I feel compelled to take in his case." End quote. The radio broadcast reached MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo before he could be informed in person. In fact, the first person to tell him was his wife Jean, who herself learned the news from a member of the general's staff. As for his designated replacement, General Ridgway, he was not made aware of these developments until a reporter congratulated him. The reporter did not elaborate on what he was congratulating him for, but Ridgway could easily surmise what had transpired. MacArthur's dismissal had been inevitable for quite some time already. Ridgway's personal feelings on the matter were mixed. On one hand, the man was a brilliant military mind, and this was reflected in his record. Everyone remembered well how he devised the Incheon operation that turned the tide of the war, to say nothing of his actions in the Pacific theater during World War II. His outsized reputation had not been fully made from whole cloth. Ridgway himself later called him, quote, "truly one of the great captains of warfare," end quote. Such a figure, Ridgway later wrote, did not deserve to be sacked in such an undignified manner. On the other hand, he was a man with deep character flaws. He was stubborn, temperamental, and highly egotistical. The course of the conflict in Korea had only made these traits worse. His judgment had become clouded, leading him to clash with his superiors. His megalomaniacal desire to eradicate the forces of communism by expanding the war into China had the potential to draw the United States and the rest of the free world headlong into an unwinnable conflict, perhaps even to a Third World War. No one had forgotten his exploits in the last World War, but that was in the past. The nature of international conflict was irrevocably changed with the advent of the atomic age, and MacArthur, it seemed, could not be reconciled to this reality. Ridgway said as much in remarks he gave to the press back in February, quote, MacArthur's strategy to extend the war to China entailed the very considerable risk of igniting World War III. It was an ambitious and dangerous program that would demand a major national effort. It is clear that the nation's top civilian and military leaders, using a wider angle lens, with deeper sources of information on the atomic situation in the Soviet Union, and with more comprehensive estimates of the possible consequences of a general global war, had a much clearer view of the responsibilities of the day. End quote. These realities and responsibilities were every bit as clear to Ridgway, too. His mission, of a far more modest scope than that of his predecessor, was to bring the war in Korea to a conclusion that was, if not ideal, then at the very least acceptable to the American government, the American people, and the free world more broadly. The day after the news broke, Ridgway flew to Tokyo for a final debriefing with his former superior. He found MacArthur to be surprisingly amiable, even helpful. Nonetheless, the old general made no effort to hide his rage against President Truman. He attributed the president's decision to sack him to, quote, a malignant hypertension, an affliction that is characterized by bewilderment and confusion of thought, end quote. He claimed to have been told this by an individual he identified only as an eminent medical man, and that said medical man predicted that Truman would be dead of his condition within the year. Douglas MacArthur's departure from Tokyo on April 16th was a highly emotional and theatrical affair. A coterie of diplomats, officials, and military personnel accompanied the general as he was driven from the U.S. Embassy to Haneda Airport. Thousands of Japanese civilians lined the streets to see him off, waving farewell and holding signs with messages written in English. One read, quote, "Goodbye, General MacArthur, we still love you," end quote. U.S. Ambassador to Japan, William Sebald, later recalled the scene, quote, "Many of the women were sobbing openly, and even a number of the battle-hardened men had difficulty in suppressing their tears," end quote. At the airport, the general was honored by an 18-gun salute, which rang out over the sound of onlookers tearfully singing Auld Lang Syne. As MacArthur boarded the airplane that was to carry him away to the United States, he turned to wave at the crowd one last time. Ambassador Sebald remarked, quote, "You would have thought that he was a conquering hero, not at all the demeanor of someone who had just been fired," end quote. MacArthur was granted a similar reception by the American public upon his return. April 18th, 1951, marked the first time he had set foot in the continental United States in 13 years, and he did so to a hero's welcome. The very next day, he delivered a stirring farewell address before a joint session of Congress. It is known unofficially as the Old Soldiers Never Die speech, a title taken from its final sentences, quote, "I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army as a boy, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many a times since I took the oath on that plain at West Point, and those hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die, they just fade away. And, just like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light with which to see it. Goodbye." End quote. Although this is the section that's best remembered, the full text of the speech is rather lengthy, and since reading it in its entirety would take at least 30 minutes, I don't think that this would be the best use of our time. To provide the broad strokes, however, most of MacArthur's speech was devoted to a recap of the history of Asia and the Pacific in the modern era, with special emphasis on the United States' interests in the region. His overall thesis might be summarized as follows, quote, "The issues we face are global and so interlocked that to consider the problems of one sector while remaining oblivious to those of another is to court disaster for the whole. While Asia is commonly referred to as the gateway to Europe, it is no less true that Europe is the gateway to Asia, and the broad influence of one cannot fail to have an impact on the other. There are those who claim that our strength is inadequate to protect on both fronts, that we cannot divide our efforts. I can think of no greater expression of defeatism. If a potential enemy can divide his strength on two fronts, it is necessary for us to counter this effort. The communist threat is a global one. Its successful advance in one sector threatens the destruction of the others. You cannot appease or otherwise surrender to communism in Asia without simultaneously undermining our efforts to halt its advance in Europe." End quote. Throughout the speech, MacArthur sought to defend his decisions, reusing the same sort of rhetoric that he had in the past. The most significant passage, at least as it regards our narrative here, is as follows, quote, "Efforts have been made to distort my position. It has been said, in effect, that I was a warmonger. Nothing could be further from the truth. I know war as few other men now living know it, and nothing to me is more revolting. I have long advocated its complete abolition, as its very destructiveness on both friend and foe has rendered it useless as a means of settling international dispute. But once war is forced upon us, there is no alternative than to apply every available means to bring it to a swift end. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. And in war, there can be no substitute for victory. End quote. As Truman and his cabinet had feared, the American public overwhelmingly sided with MacArthur, at least initially. The president's approval rating hit a new low of 23%, which remains to this day the lowest approval rating of a sitting president ever recorded by an official poll. Rallies and demonstrations in support of the general were held across the country. Future President Richard Nixon, then a Republican senator from California, claimed that his office received over 600 telegrams calling for MacArthur's reinstatement, Truman's impeachment, or for both. And this was just on the first day after the news was made public. By May, a congressional inquiry was opened into the matter. Dire as the situation may have appeared, though, President Truman maintained his composure. He stood by his decision, confident that, in his own words, quote, once all the hullabaloo died down, people would see him for what he was. End quote. He had good reason to believe that he would weather this political storm. For one, nearly every major media outlet in the United States endorsed his decision, as did a significant number of foreign publications, especially those in countries contributing directly to the United Nations mission in Korea. There had been a great deal of anxiety in Europe surrounding the possibility of an expanded conflict and the use of nuclear weapons, and needless to say, MacArthur was not doing anything to alleviate these concerns. In early April, the British Foreign Minister sent a lengthy telegram to the British Embassy in Washington, D.C., that provides some insight as to the attitudes of America's allies regarding their leadership in Korea. Quote, our principal difficulty is General MacArthur. His policy is different from that of the UN. He wants a war with China. We do not. It is no exaggeration to say that by his public utterances, he has weakened public confidence in this country and in all of Western Europe in the quality of American political judgment and leadership. Here, we have a case of a commander publicly suggesting that his policy is not in line with that stated by his government, not subject to the control of his own government, and who said government is nevertheless unwilling or unable to discipline. End quote. The extent to which pressure from the UK and other allied countries influenced Truman's decision is not known for certain, but in any event, their reaction to the news of MacArthur's dismissal was a collective sigh of relief. Editorials heaped praise on Truman for making such a difficult but necessary decision. The following excerpt appeared in the Danish newspaper Aftenbladet. Quote, the removal of MacArthur will be received with dry eyes, indeed with extraordinary relief. End quote. High-ranking politicians and diplomats also expressed their gratitude to the president, including former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman. An associate reported Schuman's reaction in the following terms, quote, he referred at once to General MacArthur's dismissal in terms of heartfelt thankfulness. He had the impression that the United States administration had nearly lost control of the situation. Unquote. This attitude was not necessarily confined to Western Europe either, although the reaction to the news among America's allies in Asia, namely Japan and South Korea, was more negative. Anyway, as for Truman's outlook on the domestic political situation, the Democratic Party's control of both the Senate and House of Representatives made the possibility of impeachment highly unlikely regardless of the results of the congressional inquiry. Said congressional inquiry, which was conducted entirely in a closed session, with only a heavily redacted transcript being made available to the public, concluded in June after cross-examining 14 witnesses, including all the Joint Chiefs of Staff, members of Truman's cabinet, and MacArthur himself. The committee found that, while the circumstances of General MacArthur's dismissal had been a shock to national pride, President Truman had acted fully within the limits of the power imposed on him by the Constitution. Thanks in part to the results of the inquiry, the public firestorm that had surrounded MacArthur's dismissal largely subsided by the end of the year. That being said, while President Truman managed to emerge on the other side of this crisis without having been removed from office, his popularity would never recover, at least not completely. But we'll have more to say on that subject in a future episode. Before moving on, though, I'd just like to briefly state that these events would have long-lasting ramifications for the United States government, its military, and the relationship between the two. The issues at stake here were a lot larger than the specific personalities of the parties involved. MacArthur's dismissal raised questions regarding civilian oversight of the military and the limits of presidential power. Questions that would resurface again and again in nearly every major military action undertaken by the United States in the time since. Again, however, a more in-depth discussion of this subject will have to wait for a future episode. So far, we've talked at great length about the various reactions to MacArthur's dismissal, among the US public and government, among America's allies in Europe and Asia, and so on. But noticeably absent from this discussion have been the soldiers in Korea themselves. But the reason for this is that the reaction among soldiers was honestly quite muted. Simply put, most enlisted men did not pay much attention to the goings-on at the highest levels of the command structure. Jim Sheldon, a lieutenant in the 17th Infantry Division, commented, quote, "MacArthur was too distant from us for his going to have much of an impact. The only thing we really noticed at the time was that the food got better after Ridgway took over," end quote. Among the officer corps, there were more ambivalent feelings on the matter. Many were of a similar mind as General Ridgway, in that they maintained a certain degree of respect for MacArthur and his past exploits, even though they largely agreed that Truman's decision had been for the greater good. Colonel Ellis Williamson summarized the prevailing opinion on the general himself when he remarked, quote, "He was a pompous old bastard, but a great soldier," end quote. Meanwhile, Colonel Paul Freeman, hero of the Battle of Chipyong-ni, spoke for many officers who found the whole affair to be somewhat unseemly, irrespective of whether or not they thought MacArthur's dismissal was justified. Quote, "I thought his sacking was disgraceful. Sure, he did have it coming. He should have been relieved. But it should have been done in a more dignified way. He was an actor, to be sure, and an egoist, but he was a very great man," end quote. Historian Max Hastings posits that on the whole, quote, "MacArthur's memory faded with remarkable speed in Korea," end quote. He attributes this primarily to the relative competence and level-headedness of his successor. Through the rest of the war, Ridgway maintained a stable working relationship with both the U.S. civilian government and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, mainly because his strategic outlook on the conflict was aligned fully with theirs. His main objective was to extricate the United States from this conflict as soon as possible by arranging a peace agreement with the communists that more or less restored the pre-war status quo. Therefore, the task that lay before him in the immediate term was to demonstrate sufficient military strength to bring the enemy to the negotiating table. But what neither he nor anyone else could have predicted was just how long the diplomatic process would take. And it's here that I will end our narrative for today. With the balance shifting once more in favor of the United Nations in Korea, and with General MacArthur now out of the picture, a path to peace now appeared to be open. But was the other side open to negotiation as well? If not, what would it take to bring them to the table? And what sacrifices would either side have to make to put an end to the bloodshed? How many more lives would be lost or destroyed in the meantime? All these questions and more will be addressed in the next episode of our series on the Korean War, which should be released, as I said, very soon. After that, Part 10 will be a diversion from the main narrative, as we discuss the most controversial aspect of the Korean War, the prisoner of war issue. After that, we will return to the main narrative for one final episode, which will cover events leading directly to the end of the war, the conclusion of the peace process, and the terms of the armistice agreement, as well as providing an extended analysis of the wider effects of the conflict. But again, you'll have to tune in later to hear all of this. In the meantime, if you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please feel free to send them my way via my email, perspectivesinhistorypod@gmail.com. I can also be reached on Facebook and the website formerly known as Twitter. Links to both pages can be found in this episode's description. If you like the show and are interested in contributing to its continuation, consider becoming a supporter on Patreon or purchasing some used books from me on eBay. Links to both of these sites will also be made available in the episode description. Anyway, that should about do it for now. Until next time, this has been the Perspectives in History podcast. Thank you very much for listening. I'm your host, Will O'Connor, signing off.